So how do lenders look at brownfield projects? That's things, you know, like how do they see that the value in wanting to lend money to somebody who's got an idea? I mean, I gotta imagine they're really cautious at times.
So it started out, you couldn't get money finance. I mean, simple. Like if it has an environmental issue, until the issues were solved, there was no financing that you could get. Starting from that basis and that foundation, things have changed dramatically over the years. I think lenders are much more sophisticated, even on complicated brownfield projects. I think if you can articulate a vision, you follow the process that we set, you're approaching it conservatively, you're using good consultants, you have a comprehensive team, you can pull all the pieces together, you can share that vision and that map and that game plan in advance. That my experience is that most lenders are very comfortable
right
now lending on those projects.
Welcome to the Environmental Transformation Podcast, where we talk with industry leaders, climate champions, and sustainability professionals who are making an impact in their businesses today. Each leader is solving complex challenges and providing solutions within their respective areas of expertise. And here's our host, Sean Grady.
Hello, ET Nation. I'm excited to announce that I've updated my website that provides listeners more access to episode content and information about the podcast. Please take a moment and visit the website and sign up for email notifications and blog postings. Also, check out our sponsors page to see who supports the show. We can't thank these industry leaders enough. Finally, I would really appreciate if you would take a moment and post a review and rate the podcast episodes either from my website or from within your podcast app. This helps the podcast get more exposure on Apple Podcasts and other podcast networks. Also, please send me comments and recommendations on topics that you want to hear about. I hope you enjoy the new website, so check it out at www.seankgrady.com.
Welcome to the Environmental Transformation Podcast. I'm your host, Sean Grady. Today's guests are Todd Davis and Bill Dennis. Guys, welcome to the show. We're here at the National Brownfield Conference in Detroit, talking about brownfield redevelopment and all the great things that go along with that. Todd, you are one of the attorneys and CFO or CEO of Hemisphere Brownfield Group. Tell us a little bit about what you do and what type of projects you work on and what services you offer.
Yeah, so great to be here. Hemisphere is an owner and redeveloper of brownfield sites. We work on transactions across the United States as well as in Canada. Started my company in 1994, so I've been doing this for a very long time.
Yeah.
Really since
almost 30 years.
Yep. Yeah. So a little over. And was doing brownfield redevelopment before that. My background, I'm an environmental lawyer, wrote the book for the American Bar Association on brownfield redevelopment.
Oh.
So hopefully gives me a really good perspective and background. You know, coming to a brownfields conference like this is like coming home.
Yeah.
So
you're with your people here.
I am with my people. That's for sure.
All right. That's awesome. Todd, talk a little bit about maybe some of the interesting current projects you currently have that you're working on.
Sure. Well, just to start, probably a couple of the biggest projects that I'm currently working on. Two are in Canada, in Montreal. Two very large pieces of property owned by Imperial Oil, which is an affiliate of ExxonMobil. I've been working on the projects for a couple of years just to position the projects for disposition and redevelopment. One's about 125 acres, just an amazingly located infill, going to be a very significant warehouse distribution facility.
Okay.
Another's about 175 acres right on the Port of Montreal. There are many different potential end uses for that piece of property, kind of working collaboratively with both the regional government in Quebec, the Montreal government, the local government. So really interesting redevelopment opportunity. And, you know, back in the U.S., working on a major redevelopment right next to the St. Louis Arch.
Right. Oh, okay.
About 100 acres of brownfield infill property right on the Mississippi. And so, kind of both ends of the spectrum there in terms of the nature of projects.
Oh, that's great. So have you had to bone up on your French?
En petit peu, as they say. And that's about all I remember of my high school French. I wish I paid more attention. That's for sure.
Okay. Bill, tell us a little bit about projects you guys may be working on.
Sure. I have to be a little bit careful because unlike Todd, I don't own these projects. And most of our current work are in confidential stages. I can't say a whole lot about them. I'll say just based on past experience that every single brownfield we work on has some level of interestingness to it. You know, some of the premier projects we've done in the past, if there's a unique client, University of Dayton comes to mind, somebody who's not traditionally a brownfield redevelopment expert or even in that space. So if you have an interesting client, makes the project worthwhile, interesting technical challenges, that sort of thing makes all those projects worthwhile. But as far as the current portfolio, I'll hit you next year.
Sure. No, that's good. Well, you know, brownfield redevelopment has been a kind of a thing, so to speak, for many years now. But talk a little bit about how has it evolved over time that, you know, in your 30 some years of doing this, what's been some changes or perspectives that really have kind of evolved over time that's changed things?
Yeah. So when we first started out, you know, in the early 90s, late 80s, early 90s, when brownfield redevelopment really started to take shape, there was no process, there were no programs, there was no predictability in terms of how you would both investigate and then remediate these sites and have a kind of a beginning, middle, and end to the project. There was no holistic approach to redeveloping these kind of opportunities. With the rise of state voluntary cleanup programs, and really that's what I wrote my book about, it's come up with a really concrete, direct process and structure to redevelop the sites. And that's when, you know, we can better integrate companies and professions like Phil and his company. You know, he mentioned a project that we worked on collaboratively with the University of Dayton. You know, the integration of those skill sets, both from legal to development to environmental consulting to demolition to infrastructure, you know, those are things that we think about now that we never thought about, you know, in the start of the process.
Right. Yeah, I kind of remember, you know, you'd get these brownfield grants and most of the stakeholders who could receive them were municipalities, and they were really the only ones who could get any grants back in the day. Has that changed over time now where, you know, private industry or private developers can also obtain these types of grants to redevelop properties?
Yeah, so it's changed depending on where you are.
Okay.
You know, so USEPA tends to make sure that eligibility for those grants typically has to run through a nonprofit or a government entity.
Okay.
But there's a lot more collaboration between private developers and public entities now. So, you know, people like me in the brownfield redevelopment business, we're always building those layers of connectivity so that we can access grant funding to mitigate those costs.
Right.
On the other end of the spectrum, so we're both based in Ohio. There's a state brownfield program, and a lot of the money, candidly, in Ohio is coming through directly from the state. Over the last now 4 years, about $700 million in new grants that are available to support brownfield redevelopment, and that money can go directly to developers. So there have been an explosion of projects across Ohio to address these historically contaminated sites, and it's a very robust market. I don't know how you did that.
No, I was going to mention the Ohio aspect because that's been the big change, right? With the latest rounds of funding is that the private entities receiving that money makes the project slightly more efficient, and it has jump-started probably some projects that wouldn't have moved forward.
Yeah.
So that's why you've seen a spike in activity in Ohio. They've done a great job. The best way to use stimulus money, in my opinion.
Yeah, no, that's good. And yeah.
And well, I would just say that, you know, the amount of leverage that you get in those projects, I mean, even when you look at any of the metrics that and they're conservative, the way the state rolls it out, you're getting leverage like, you know, for every public dollar invested, there's 13 to 15 private dollars invested.
Mm-hmm.
So return on investment is awfully good.
Yeah.
So
well, that's really good.
It's about how you layer and layer these.
Bring all the stakeholders together too, right? That's the key, right? That seems to be.
That is the key.
How do you bring all the stakeholders together to buy in on the vision? Like if you're a municipality and you know you've got brownfield projects or sites in your community that have been an eyesore, so to speak, for a long time, how do they go about engaging the owners and then identifying a developer or reach out to an attorney that says, hey, I can help you? Like, I gotta imagine they struggle to really get things going and to figure out a way to redevelop something that's, you know, economically viable for the community.
So it's challenging. It really depends on, it goes back to real estate 101, you know, location, location,
yeah.
Location. So, you know, when I thought about this from an evaluation perspective, you know, the problems that are the projects that are interesting to a for-profit developer whose purpose is to not only do great projects and redevelop them, but, you know, make a living at doing that. They're very different dynamics and metrics that you have to hit, as opposed to, you know, you're the stakeholder of the community that's got a contaminated site and it's not really worried about that kind of return. You've got to look at different ways to stack the capital so that you can address those issues. And I guess what I would say is, going back to some of the problems, you know, one of the biggest barriers or problems is that communities like that aren't proactive enough and they don't do the easy things that you need to do to mitigate risk. Mm. So for example, an easy thing would be have the city council, have the mayor or the executive be a cheerleader for the project.
Oh yeah.
Be a facilitator.
Yeah.
Instead, they tend to be, or oftentimes are less active. You know, one of the things that developers really look for when choosing whether to participate in a program or a project like that is, are we going to have a facilitative government that we can
work with,
appropriately engage with,
right,
and work with? And obviously they've got their interests that they need to protect, which any good developer is going to be respectful of.
Right.
But it's a tremendous difference in working with a community that has a common vision and is looking to help facilitate rather than even be just kind of neutral about the project.
Right.
It doesn't cost anything. And that's one of the things that even helping to leverage and get into those US EPA grants that are, you know, there's $1.5 billion of new grant funding that was just put into brownfield redevelopment in the last round of legislation at the federal level. That's an awful lot of money that's going to be spread throughout the United States over the next few years.
That's going to be great.
So
it's really going to help communities, you know, deal with these types of projects.
This podcast is supported by GHD Digital. GHD Digital has over 600 employees globally, supporting its clients with advanced metering infrastructure design and implementation services, mixed reality and digital engineering services that help decision-making through the development of 3D conceptual site models, EHS compliance software helping clients manage their waste and circular economy programs, digital automation services, regenerative AI services, and so much more. To learn more about GHD Digital, check out their website at www.ghd.com.
What are some of the biggest barriers that you guys see with redeveloping projects today?
With brownfield projects, they're so complex. It's always been complex. Some of that complexity has been smoothed out over time with regulators creating some flexibility, creating frameworks to actually allow you to move those projects and have good targets. But the complexity remains and the risk mitigation remains. And so with that, there's lots of barriers within the risk mitigation matrix that pop up all the time. That complexity is never going to go away because these are just going to be in a project. You also have things like technical challenges these days that are popping up, you know, for the past, 5-10 years have been indoor air.
Right.
Didn't want to go down that path, but they have to. And indoor air has become a technical challenge. It's been a bit of a constraint. It's been a little bit of an afterthought in some of the brownfield planning and brings along some surprise costs. Now you have things like PFAS popping up.
Yeah, they do.
That would be the next great, you know, technical challenge that's going to really inhibit all projects from moving forward, but in particular brownfield projects, because with the complexity and the other constraints we have to overcome on a brownfield site, there's not a lot of funding or risk mitigation left over to handle some of those added challenges.
Oh, yeah, I see that for sure. You know, and maybe Todd, you can handle this one. You develop a project, you get going, and maybe you missed something. Let's just say we missed like the VI.
In theory. Like, we never missed anything. No surprise on Brownfield.
Never. Ever. Right. So you develop the project, it gets in place, and all of a sudden, you're like the occupants are complaining. And you're like, what's going on? And of course, it's a VI. How do you address, say, those types of issues? Is it through proper insurance? Is it through, you know, liability, you know, transfers? Or, you know, talk a little bit about how you structure, I guess, safety nets for projects like that.
Yeah, so So that's a good way to look at it. So we always look at projects. We break it down into constraints. And we break it down into buckets of liability. And then, you know, candidly, our approach is belt, suspenders, and another belt. That's the way we look at mitigating and managing risk. So when I'm doing a project, the metrics that we use to measure ourselves are, obviously, we want to maximize value. We want to minimize costs within the applicable regulations. But we want to manage long-term risk and liability comprehensively.
Right.
So how do we do that? We address it at the federal level by addressing all appropriate inquiries and qualifying for CERCLA, BFPP, safe harbors from liability at the federal level. We're always taking our projects through state voluntary action programs, doing investigations to comprehensively and conservatively address, you know, the impacts to the pieces of real estate, and then pursuing a no further action letter or covenant not to sue. And then finally, at the same time, using environmental insurance. We use environmental insurance on a tool on every single redevelopment that we do. It's an extraordinarily cost-effective tool, and it protects you during the redevelopment process. And if surprises come up, later.
Down the road, too.
Yeah, and I can say I've placed environmental insurance on every single project. I've been involved in one claim out of, you know, maybe 100 projects that we've worked on, you know, about. And candidly, the insurance responded very directly to the issue that was uncovered. So, great tool to consider.
Oh, that's great.
Yeah, I think the best thing, just to add to that, too, at a localized level, the best thing you can do is put together the right team from the get-go and get the comprehensive skill sets covered.
Right.
You know, and, you know, don't forget about things. You need
right.
everything on these projects.
Right.
You need PR, you need finance, you need banking, you need legal, you need environmental, you need geotechnical. Don't skip out on any of those aspects. If you have the right team in place, that gives you your best tool to mitigate those risks, backed up by the belt and suspenders.
That's a good way to look at it, because, you know, sometimes early due diligence happens, and you know, you might rely on it, but it wasn't done all that great, right? And now it kind of catches you off guard when you thought it, you know, you had it covered. So yeah, I could see why that'd be important.
So it comes up in, you know, how you're underwriting these projects also, right? I mean, you want to be able to rely on, you know, great professionals, as Bill pointed out. Firms such as your firm to do the environmental due diligence necessary to comprehensively investigate the site.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we lean heavily on our environmental consulting partners to help us manage that risk comprehensively. So, you know, one of the biggest issues that you find is that a lot of people and developers, especially some of my brethren in the development business, you know, cost is always an issue. They sometimes go toward the least cost provider of services.
Right.
That's a huge issue.
Mistake, right?
No, I mean, you know, penny wise, pound foolish.
Right.
And, you know, the small mistakes or the small cost savings that you can get by using someone who might have the depth of services and experience seems like it might be good up front. But if you run into a problem and you don't know how to address it, it makes up for it in the back end.
Sure. No, that's a great, great point. And I'm glad you brought that up. I think that's real important because not everybody's going to be taking, you know, the cheap route, but some will go and spend the extra money to, you know, use a consultant or, you know, a firm that really has the bench strength to address the now what, you know, after you do the initial, right?
So you have to. You have to be prudent about approaching especially complicated brownfield sites. You just have to be smart about how you approach all these issues.
Yeah, no, I totally agree. How are you addressing like the full stakeholder engagement, the environmental justice side of the house when it comes to brownfield redevelopment? That's such a big, important aspect of the success of making a project work in a community, and especially in a disadvantaged community and where they're really, you know, struggling and historically have a lot of issues. How are you engaging those and bringing stakeholders together to bring projects together?
So Bill had mentioned, you know, one of the projects that we worked on jointly was a major redevelopment from the University of Dayton in Dayton, Ohio. And effectively what we were doing is working with the university to help them double the size of their campus on a major brownfield site.
Oh, wow.
So a huge project, very high stakes for the university. They were landlocked. They were desperately looking for a place to expand. They've been staring at this brownfield property. It was really the only place that they could potentially expand for decades.
Right.
It was owned by NCR, National Cash Register. They built all the cash registers from the beginning of time on this piece of property. So a 50-acre site, lots of environmental issues, solvent impact to demolition impact, just a litany of different issues.
Right.
Underneath the site was what was called a critical resource groundwater. So it's highly protected groundwater in the state of Ohio, but it's also in an urban area. We have a tool called the urban setting designation, where you basically can work with the regulatory authority to cut off the drinking water pathway if you can make certain demonstrations to Ohio EPA. That had never been done on this piece of property, or this kind of groundwater resource in the state of Ohio. Enter public engagement. So the university wanted to reach out to every potential stakeholder literally around the city of Dayton in order to engage them in this process. We had 79 public meetings, literally, in connection with trying to address the concerns of the stakeholders. I mean, it's more public meetings than any private developer would ever do on any project, bar none. But that being said, we got critical support by engaging early and often with the community.
Right.
That support allowed us to secure the urban setting designation on this piece of property. That resulted in probably a $45 million savings on remediation costs from not having to remediate, you know,
certain parts of the property,
groundwater to drinking water standards.
Oh, wow.
So we still met our requirements under a state voluntary cleanup program.
Right.
So I guess the main point is, you know, sometimes it's uncomfortable to go out and raise issues, especially thorny issues with the community. The bottom line is it's worth it.
It's worth
every minute that you do it.
Right.
And it's going to come back to haunt you if you don't.
Yeah. Great point.
And it's a strategy, right? I mean, it's like doing your phase one. I mean, it's got to be part of your program.
Right. It's a piece of the toolkit that you have to deploy every time you do a project, right?
Exactly.
We had such a great time conducting live interviews at the National Brownfields Conference this year. Here at the Environmental Transformation Podcast, we are always looking for guests to come onto the show and talk about what they are doing in this exciting field. That's what this platform is for, highlighting people and companies making an impact in our industry. If you want to be a guest on our show, email me at seankgrady@yahoo.com and let me know what you want to talk about with the ET Nation. Who knows? Maybe you'll be my next guest.
You know, early on redevelopment, you know, of course they had stakeholders, but they weren't really like perfecting the engagement process in a way that made it, you know, more successful. There's always contention versus, okay, this is a good idea. We like your ideas, or, well, we like the idea, but we got some ideas too. And then you collaboratively kind of get to a common goal, right? So,
yeah, I think the, you know, the way you're describing it is correct. I mean, there are some, there are different categories of stakeholders. It's important to be honest and transparent with the process, and it can't be just messaging. You have to have open ears, and you have to have kind of a blank slate in terms of what your thoughts are.
Yeah.
And then try to reach consensus. It takes time. It's not a one, we'll have two public meetings and we'll reach consensus. This is building a relationship of trust with stakeholders. It won't be perfect.
Right.
You won't have complete unanimity in terms of approach, but you can't expect that.
No. Yeah, exactly. You know, Todd, maybe you know, how do lenders look at brownfield projects? That's things, you know, like how do they see that the value in wanting to lend money to somebody who's got an idea? I mean, you gotta imagine they're really cautious at times.
So it started out, you couldn't get money to finance. I mean, it was simple. Like if it has an environmental issue, until the issue's resolved, there was no financing that you could get. Starting from that basis and that foundation, you know, things have changed dramatically over the years. I think lenders are much more sophisticated, even on complicated brownfield projects. I think if you can articulate a vision, you follow the process that we set, you're approaching it conservatively, you're using good consultants, you have a comprehensive team, you can pull all the pieces together, you can share that vision and that map and that game plan in advance. That my experience is that most lenders are very comfortable now lending on those projects. They may wait until you get to a certain phase. So often we use, you know, traditional equity an earlier, the riskiest parts of the project.
Yeah.
And then we use loans as a takeout. That being said, there's a lot more public lending programs, especially at the state level, that will lend on brownfield sites. So, well, listen, all developers want grants. I mean, that's what we want.
Right.
But alternatively, and again, speaking in the state of Ohio, you can get, you know, $5 million loans from Ohio EPA to do your initial due diligence, which ultimately can be taken out by permanent lending when you get to that phase. So
that's a pretty good deal.
There's a lot more optionality in terms of how you would structure a deal, which simply wasn't in existence when the program started.
Yeah, it seems like, you know, that evolution of the program over the past 20, 30 years, that's been one of the strengths, is now funding is more available.
Absolutely.
You know, in addition to other technology type functionalities that really help.
Well, lenders are more comfortable, going back to your point, like before there was no comfort at all because their lawyers scared them to death that they shouldn't be lending. And what happens if the developer defaults? The bank's not going to foreclose on a contaminated property. Now there's a process, you know, again, banks don't want to take over contaminated property.
Right.
That being said, it's much easier to find a developer who will step into the shoes. It's not voodoo anymore.
Right.
You don't have to necessarily be a brownfield redeveloper. A lot of traditional developers are getting in the space, as I'm sure you've seen.
Sure.
And, you know, we tend to team with traditional developers often when they want to shift those responsibilities to us.
Yeah.
But we do a lot more collaboration on issues like that just to make sure that we're hitting all the points that we need.
That's great. That's really good. You know, how do you think, or how do you see infrastructure help playing a role in redevelopment? You know, the infrastructure bill that was, you know, issued by the government is loaded with lots of money. But, you know, I got to imagine municipalities or communities are also trying to figure out how do they, you know, plan around the development with their infrastructure. You know, talk a little bit about how that kind of factors into redevelopment.
So infrastructure is often overlooked. It's part of that comprehensive approach to redeveloping a site that you have to look at. It's one of the more expensive things that is often overlooked. You know, as you're doing your planning, I can tell you, you know, some of the biggest challenges on our sites in Montreal are old infrastructure with an old community that hasn't kept up with some of the investments that, you know, newer communities might have done. So they're suffering with some of the underinvestment historically. And as we look to redevelop, you know, $500 million of new development, infrastructure costs are critical. How you do it, when you do it, how you can connect a new, how you connect the new to the old, those are critically important. So again, go back to team. When you're looking at these sites, you got to bring in a team.
You got to bring a team in.
As Bill articulated, you know, it is a web of professionals to do big projects the right way. The great advantage is that now it's predictable. You know the issues. There's no
success rate is much more.
It's much higher.
Much higher. Yeah.
If you pick the right team, there is not a project that you can't effectively redevelop if you do your planning correctly. If you have the right team, and you're working within a community that's supportive.
Yeah. Yeah. I totally agree with that. That's great. Well, gentlemen, I mean, thank you for coming on the show today. I really appreciate you giving your insights on brownfield redevelopment. For the listeners, Todd has a good way to get a hold of you. If there's someone's listening and says, I want to work with this guy, or Bill, the same thing. I mean, tell the listeners how to get a hold of you.
So the best way is go to our website, HemisphereDev, www.hemispheredev.com. That's the best way to get a hold of me, and look forward to the opportunity to work with whomever's listening.
Yeah, right. Bill? Yeah,
similarly, Webb's the best bet. So ardentenvironmental.com, ardentenvironmental.com. With us directly there. You can always call you and you can get them.
Absolutely. We'll put your contact information up on the website as well. And gentlemen, thanks for coming on the show. Really appreciate it. And all the best of luck in the conference.
Thanks a lot. Thanks for having us.
All right.
Bye-bye.
Thank our guests Todd Davis and Bill Dennis for being my guests as we conducted this interview at the National Brownfield Conference this year. If you want to learn more about the Hemisphere Brownfield Group or Ardent, we'll put a link to their contact information on my website. To listen to future environmental transformation podcasts, you can check us out on all the major podcast networks or from my website at www.seankgrady.com. And remember, don't forget to follow us and please write a review about this episode. Also, if you're watching on YouTube, please subscribe to the channel. Well, thanks for listening, and until next time, make a positive impact in someone's life today.